Wir wollen fragen, ob Sie daran glauben, dass Google auch in 20 Jahren noch ein ebenso mächtiger Konzern sein wird wie heute.
Well, you know, this is where being a science fiction writer is very useful, because science fiction writers understand that only an idiot tries to predict the future 20 years from now. And that's good, because if we were able to predict the future 20 years from now, then it wouldn't matter what we did, right? The reason the future can't be predicted is because what humans do changes the future. And as someone who uses the internet and thinks that it's a very important force, it's the place where we're going to have all the important debates about climate and race and gender and inequality, and who wants a free and open internet, I'm way more interested in the question of what do we do to make sure that the internet is better 20 years from now than predicting what the internet will be 20 years from now. Because I hope that such a prediction is impossible, because I hope that the actions that we take will make those predictions moot.
Wir würden gern gleich darüber sprechen, aber zuerst würde ich gerne noch eine Frage zu Google stellen. Viele nehmen Google ja als eine Suchmaschine wahr, was sicherlich auch stimmt, aber es hat sich viel in den letzten Jahren verändert. Sie forschen zu künstlicher Intelligenz oder denken Sie an Calico, das sich damit beschäftigt, das Leben zu verlängern. Was ist Google für Sie?
So I think that Google is a good example of what happens when we get rid of all of the anti-monopoly rules and all the antitrust rules, and we make it easy for tax evasion to take place. And what happens is companies get so big that they can't figure out what to spend their money on. And one of several things happens. One is that they start going off on strange projects like infinite life prolongation. And the other one is that they engage in financial engineering, where they do things like stock buybacks and lobbying governments for baroque rules that allow them to maintain their dominance. And so Google, on the one hand, is, you know, I think arguably the best search engine we have. And on the other hand, is this giant octopus, not unlike all the other big giant octopuses that have so much money that they can't figure out what to do with it, and that end up spending a lot of it on corrupt practices and purposes. And, you know, I think it's important to note that although Google itself is a company that has a unique culture and some unique characteristics, its major institutional shareholders are literally the same major institutional shareholders behind every other large Fortune 100 or FTSE 100 corporations. That one of the implications of there being a 1% is that there aren't very many 1%ers, right? Only 1% of the world is in the 1%. And those people, their investment choices tend to be spread around everything. And so we sometimes say, oh, well, you know, Google is fighting Universal or Bertelsmann or one of the other big entertainment companies. But when you look at their shareholder tables, it's just the same people hiring different people to maximize their return on investment. And the people that they're hiring are trying to increase their bonuses by attacking the other people who've been hired by the same rich people to maximize their returns. And really, it's, you know, we're talking about the global investor class gnawing on its own bones.
Da könnte man natürlich jetzt als nächstes fragen, ab von den ganzen inhaltlichen Punkten, die mit Google zu tun haben, ob Sie genau das, was Sie beschrieben haben, gerne ändern würden.
Ha! Well, you know, I as I said before about the future, I don't know how to predict the future. I know how, but I do know how to map a course. So, and this comes to me from my experience in computer science and software. So oftentimes we ask software to solve a problem that's so big that we can't even define the whole problem. We sometimes say, you know, you have to traverse a terrain that's so big you can't even know it, that by the time you've enumerated the whole terrain, the terrain has already changed. So you can't ever make a map before you start your journey. And so we have a mechanism in software for solving those unmappable journeys, and it's called hill climbing. And the hill climbing takes the metaphor of being an ant. So an ant has these forward-facing eyes. They can't look up, but an ant needs to find high ground. And so what an ant does is it checks to see which of its legs is higher than the rest, so which leg is in the highest ground, and it takes a step that way. And from that new place, its legs are now sensing new ground, and it finds another piece of high ground to take a step towards. And taking one step at a time without knowing the terrain, and even if the terrain is changing, the ant can find the highest ground available to it on the slope that it's on. And the way that that works in solving political problems is you check to see where you have some freedom of motion to make the situation better. And if you have some freedom of motion, like maybe you can pass a law, or maybe you can start a business, or maybe you can write some code, or maybe you can get a pressure group to change the conversation, you take that step. And when that step is done, you inevitably find that there is new paths that have opened up. And if we tried to plot out A to Z like a novelist, by the time we'd finished plotting it out, the terrain between, say, C and Z would have already changed. First of all, because the world is changing. But second of all, because the people who like things the way they are, the people who are benefiting from the monopolism of the platforms, they're going to actively try to change the terrain to make it harder for us to get to our goal. And so for me, I don't know how we get from A to Z, but I know how we chart the course. And you know, I think that we can make laws that make it easier to make Google and the other big giants more manageable. Like, for example, we could make them pay their taxes. If those companies had to pay their taxes, they would have a harder time outcompeting local companies, smaller companies that don't have the surplus capital to spend on tax evasion strategies. Or we could make them allow third parties to interoperate with their service, right? That's a kind of code intervention where we say, all right, when Google started, they crawled the whole internet, they looked at every web page on every service, and they used that to build a giant business. But if you go to Google and you try to crawl Google and get every web page on their service, they will take technological and legal countermeasures to shut you down.
Ich würde gerne noch über ein weiteres Beispiel sprechen. Es gibt ja viele Vorbehalte gegenüber Google, außer ihnen auch in der EU, vor allem wegen seiner Marktmacht und der Intransparenz gegenüber seines Algorithmus. Und in Europa wird nun versucht, diese Marktmacht einzuschränken, zum Beispiel durch den Artikel 13 der Urheberrechtslinie der Europäischen Union. Damit sollen Upload-Filter eingeführt werden, zum Beispiel auf Plattformen wie Googles YouTube. Und darüber wird am kommenden Mittwoch im EU-Parlament abgestimmt. Was wird aber damit vor allem erreicht? Wird damit das Urheberrecht tatsächlich gestärkt?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that this on the one hand won't help and on the other hand it will do harm. So the proposal right now is that a system that's similar to YouTube's Content ID system, which allows rights holders to send works to the system and claim copyright in them, and then allows YouTube to block anything that seems to be a match for any of these known copyrighted works, that they should have to build these systems for all kinds of content on all platforms, that we should be screening all the text that we post to Facebook and Twitter and to our WordPress blogs, that we should be forced to filter all of the audio, all of the video, all of the code, everything that gets uploaded. And we don't really have anything that does this. We have a kind of approximation or a primitive version of it in the form of Content ID, which is what YouTube uses. That costs $60 million to develop. And the people who will tell you most insistently that it doesn't do enough to stop copyright infringement are the big rights holders. They will tell you that they find it completely inadequate for their purposes. But the people who will tell you that it causes harm is everybody else. So a German music professor called Ulrich Kaiser a few weeks ago tried uploading public domain recordings of Brahms and Wagner and Beethoven to YouTube to see what would happen. And what he found was that in nearly every case, this public domain music that belongs to the world was blocked by YouTube because the giant rights holder companies had laid claim to it. And they did so knowing that YouTube couldn't tell the difference between a public domain recording and a copyrighted recording. It's gone further than that. We now have classical pianists who are checking this out by uploading their own recordings of themselves playing these compositions by composers who have been dead for 300 years and being told that they're pirates for using that music because Universal or the other big publishers have laid claims to them. And I think that when you see how that will play out across other content types, it gets very dangerous. So YouTube only allows major rights holders to lay claim to copyrights using Content ID, but the European Union's proposal allows all rights holders to do it. In fact, one of the things that they say is they want to protect the little guy. And so that means that anyone can upload anything to these upload filters. I could take the full works of William Shakespeare and upload them to WordPress and say, I own all of these words. And nobody could quote Shakespeare on their blogs until someone at WordPress went in and removed all of those millions of claims I'd made. And as soon as they'd done that, I could use a bot to upload another million claims, and there'd be no penalties for me. So you can see how this could be used for censorship. You know, in the last but one of the Turkish elections, there was audio of senior ministers in Erdogan's regime arranging bribes and other corrupt practices that showed up on YouTube. Eventually, Turkey actually blocked YouTube in the country to stop people from seeing this ahead of an election. But, you know, in the future, they wouldn't have to do this. They could just hire some trolls to upload that audio to YouTube and claim copyright in it. And by the time YouTube sorted out these fraudulent copyright claims, the election would have already gone by. So we are creating a system whose flaws we're already familiar with. And rather than trying to address those flaws, we're magnifying them. But worst of all, I think, is the effect that this is going to have on European business, European competitors to Google. Because Google has already demonstrated that they can afford to build these filters. They're the only ones who've done so. The other big platforms, they have enough money to do it too, in part because of all the money they've stolen from the public by avoiding taxes. But if you're a little European company trying to start out and make a local competitor to Google, a local competitor to Facebook or Twitter, one that respects privacy, one that polices harassment, one that isn't based on surveillance, one that pays its taxes, you don't have the capital to begin with. You don't have hundreds of millions of euros to spend on one of these. What the European Union is fundamentally proposing to do is sell Google a license to be the last search engine we ever have in exchange for a few hundred million euros for German newspaper families and other content barons. And this will be at the detriment of all European internet users, including me. I'm a European myself.
Das ist ja die eine Sache sozusagen, und weil es jetzt gerade mehrfach Erwähnung fand, können wir auch gleich über die andere Sachen die sprechen, die immer mit Google Erwähnung finden, das ist der Datenschutz. Google weiß ja sehr viel über seine Nutzer. In Deutschland zum Beispiel sind 90% der Internetnutzer auch Google-Nutzer. In der Vergangenheit hat Google ja auch sehr viel Geld von Sicherheitsdiensten bekommen, um eine Infrastruktur aufzubauen, die dann später erst bekannt wurde über die Snowden-Enthüllung. Auch heute arbeitet Google noch mit der DARPA, einer Wissenschaftsorganisation, die mit dem Militär zusammenarbeitet. Google ist ein wichtiger Partner geworden und damit eben auch ein Geheimnisträger, also ein Partner für den Staat. Was für Auswirkungen kann denn diese Partnerschaft in Zukunft haben?
Well, I think that you've hit on something very important, which is how the tech revolution has made mass surveillance affordable for governments, and not just governments in the Five Eyes or in the EU, but governments all over the world. That we have the rise of these turnkey surveillance states like Ethiopia, which, you know, they don't have any intrinsic technical capacity. They don't have their own tech scene. What they do is they buy in surveillance tools from mostly European companies. Italy is a major exporter. And they use that to affect mass surveillance on their own populations. And I think that, you know, it's been a remarkable generational change. So, you know, 30-some years ago, the Stasi paid one informant for every 60 people in the DDR. But today, the NSA is able to spy on everyone in the world by having one spy for every 10,000 people. So from 1 to 60 to 1 to 10,000, we've had this enormous productivity gain, this kind of horrific productivity gain in surveillance efficiency. And in large part, that's because we're paying the bill for our own surveillance. When we use Google, when we use mobile devices, when we pay our mobile phone bills, we are funding the databases that the world's surveillance companies agencies rely on to effect cost-effective surveillance. Google is but one of the many companies engaged in this. Although the data that they have is remarkably large, Google actually does have a small but important difference between it and the other tech giants. And that's this much-derided slogan, "Don't be evil." So, right now, the thing that tech companies find the hardest to get is not money or customers, it's qualified engineers. there is a global shortage of qualified engineers. This is why, for example, in the AI world, AI researchers are commanding salaries of $1 million a year or more, because they have a seller's market for their labor. And one of the things that Google has done to lure a certain segment of engineers into their doors is to make Don't Be Evil part of how they describe their business. Now, I'll be the first to tell you that they don't always live up to that principle. Maybe it's more the exception than the rule. But, you know, there's this saying that everyone fails up to live up to their own principles, but some of us fail to live up to principles that are better than others. So Facebook, if they had a slogan, would be as evil as possible, and then kid yourself that you're not being evil. And Apple's would be, don't be evil unless it involves locking out your competition, in which case, be as evil as you want. Or if the Chinese government asks you to be evil, that's okay too. So don't be evil. It's an important normative statement, and we've seen it play out. Google recently proposed doing a contract for the Pentagon providing AI services for drone warfare. And 10% of Google's engineering staff signed a letter saying that the company shouldn't do it. And that drone warfare contract, it was actually a test balloon for a much larger contract to provide the entire IT infrastructure to the Pentagon, a project called JEDI, the Joint Electronic Defense Initiative. And that would have been worth something like $19 billion. And because 10% of Google's staff said, we will leave, or we will see the company in a worse light if you do this, Google had to walk away from that multi-billion dollar contract. Now, that's a thing that could have happened at any tech company, but the reason it happened first at Google is because some of those engineers are able to go to work in the morning because they work for a company whose slogan is don't be evil. And every time Google sits down to plan something evil, one of the things they have to put on the balance sheet is not just the profits that they will derive from evilness, but the costs that they'll bear in terms of losing key staff. Because if you're going to work for someone evil, why not work for Facebook? They might be closer to your home, their cafeteria serves nicer food. What's the point in working for Google if Google is just as evil as Facebook? So I think that's a really important distinction that's lost on people who only notice the times that Google is evil and don't think about the motives of the people who are actually doing the work at Google.
Kürzlich haben Sie ja bekannt, hat Google ja bekannt gegeben, dass man diesen Slogan Don't Be Evil gar nicht mehr benutzen möchte. Macht das irgendeinen Unterschied?
That's actually not true. They just moved it to a different part of their mission statement. It's slightly more nuanced than that. So they moved it from the company's core mission statement to part of a statement of principles that's in a different document. Arguably they've made it less important, but like, I don't think that they've abolished it. If anything, they've just made it part of a broader set of principles. And actually, the other principles that they enumerate in that document are not terrible either. You know, I think that there's like a mistake that we make when we talk about the negative impacts of technology, whether that's Google or Uber or, Facebook. And what we say is these companies with their terrible back-end practices are bad, and therefore everything they do is bad. But, you know, being able to get a car wherever you are without having to stand on the street with your arm out, and if you're a taxi driver, being able to find out where your riders are without having to drive around and around looking for someone with their arm out, that's positive. The negative is that it's run by a rapacious company called Uber, whose founders think that Ayn Rand was a political philosopher instead of a hack novelist. And, you know, there are ways in which people have taken the Uber idea and made it a social benefit. So in Austin, Texas, Uber and Lyft left the city because they didn't like the regulations the city was imposing on them. And the drivers formed a cooperative that made a clone of Uber called Ride. It's owned by the drivers. It pays the drivers 25% more than Uber or Lyft. And people in Austin and taxi drivers in Austin now have a better service. So the problem isn't that Google exists and provides us with search tools. The problem is that Google has metastasized into this giant rapacious data baron that avoids its taxes, collaborates with the military, and so on. But, you know, you don't have to be a science fiction writer to imagine how you might have a Google that didn't do those things.
Aber lassen Sie uns genau mal zum Science Fiction Schreiber zurückkommen. In Ihren Büchern entwickeln Sie ja nämlich auch immer wieder Strategien, wie man sich gegen diese negativen Entwicklungen zur Wehr setzen kann.
So, again, back to this idea that we use code and law and norms and markets to fight problems in the world. You know, there's proposals now at the EU. They've just been a bunch of amendments this morning at the EU that propose that there be blanket licensing for, say, news articles or other copyrighted works that Google and its products currently display. If those licensing terms were non-discriminatory and open to all comers, then new entities that entered the market would be able to gain access to the same content that Google has access to. In the United States, there are these legal initiatives to weaken the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that make it illegal to do normal competitive things like scraping Google to make a new service out of it, or like jailbreaking phones to allow third-party operating systems and apps on them. So that's the kind of legal stuff we can do. On the normative side, I think that, you know, the trajectory of the normative discussion about surveillance is moving in the direction where making someone use, say, Google or Facebook in order to attend a party or to do something else that's kind of social, and to therefore subject themselves to surveillance just to do normal things, that is increasingly becoming socially unacceptable. That it's becoming like subjecting your friends to secondhand smoke, you know, to make them use Facebook to come to a kid's birthday party, or make them use Google to get directions to an event. On the market side, there are a bunch of European startups. You know, in Czechia, there's a search engine that people use that's more popular than Google in Czechia. In Bulgaria, there's a photo sharing app that's more popular than Instagram. And making sure that whatever we do to tame Google doesn't crush these companies is really important, to make sure that we have a diversity of experiences. Because although Google has a monopoly on the internet in Europe, it doesn't have a monopoly on good ideas for the internet in Europe. There are plenty of Europeans with great ideas who need to have the space to operate in, even though they can't afford the kind of compliance we want to impose on Google and the other big American companies. And then on the code side, you know, we increasingly have libraries of free and open code that anyone can look at and inspect, that provide overlays to Google services or alternatives to them, whether that's OpenStreetMap or Mastodon or any of the other services that people are building in these open and transparent ways. And one of the things we have to make sure of is that we're not making it illegal, for example, to build strong cryptography into these tools so that they can respect our privacy. You know, one of the implications of the big platforms serving as a kind of privacy, a surveillance backend to the world's surveillance companies, is that they're going to become less and less vociferous, or less and less staunch in their defense of cryptography and other privacy tools, and more willing to compromise on that, because they're going to be collecting billings from governments for providing surveillance services. You know, AT&T revealed last year that one of its most profitable lines of business is selling surveillance to the U.S. government, surveillance of the whole internet to the U.S. government, by spying on its own customers and on the business customers who use its lines for long-haul traffic. And so we need to make sure that there's code libraries that perform these essential functions of providing privacy and integrity to our data, and that so long as that exists, there will be a meaningful way in which companies that aren't the big platforms can offer an advantage that the big platforms can't. That the big platforms can't promise that they're not selling your secrets to governments, but the little companies can be more transparent and show you that they respect your privacy.
Es gibt ja einige Autoren, die sich daran versucht haben, Science Fiction über Google oder eine große Suchmaschine zu schreiben. Könnten Sie sich das auch vorstellen?
Oh, I actually wrote a fairly infamous story more than 10 years ago called Scroogled. So a magazine that's now defunct. They were destroyed by financial engineering in the crisis of 2008 called Radar, paid me to write a story where the brief was, tell me about the day that Google becomes evil. And so I wrote this story called Scroogled. It's also available in German if you do a little Googling. It's, you know, it's Creative Commons licensed. You'll find it all over the internet. You know, in that story, I talk about what it would be like to be a Google engineer and to discover that the company that you worked for and that you built the tools for had become evil. I think that there are lots of people who've lived through that experience in lots of domains. I mean, most famously, Robert Oppenheimer watching the first nuclear blast and quoting the Bhagavad Gita and saying, I'm become death, the destroyer of worlds, and then devoting the rest of his professional career to fighting nuclear proliferation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Genau. Bis zum nächsten Mal.
Nächstes Mal. Nächstes Mal. Ja, nächstes Mal. All right, see you guys. Bye.